Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Hi, folks. I thought we'd have a quick discussion about just the state of the country as it is at the moment, because it's very clear to everyone that things are going wrong, but the people who are in charge of the country and the various layers of political management, the local councils, the media, the academics, that there's a general sense that this has all gotten away from everyone and that they don't know what to do. And so the answers that they present to us are just more of the same. This is morally the right thing to do, and therefore we're going to continue doing it. And well, we just got to hope we can keep the lid on the pressure cooker, because otherwise things go horribly, horribly wrong. The problem that they have is that the pressure is building quite high, and it looks like the lid isn't going to be kept on the pressure cooker. And so we have to go back to the original assumptions that built the society we currently have, the values that we're told are British values that have made this society the brilliant society that it is, and ask ourselves whether there have been any mistaken assumptions, perhaps, at the bottom of them. And so we live in what I'm going to call a social contract society. Now, we don't have a social contract. You might be thinking of the United States with their constitution. That is a social contract society that has a social contract. France is a social contract society, or at least a society masquerading as a social contract society that has a social contract, for good or for ill. We don't have that. You don't have a list of enumerated rights in a document that you can use to make an appeal through the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court in this country is a bit of a strange beast because it has to use precedent that is built up through common law and legislation, which all can be changed at any time by any government. So you are in a particularly strange position, because this is a bit alien to us, is the way that things are in this country. We are not a social contract society. We are a familial society. We are a tribal society. We are a historic, sentimental society. And so having this imposed upon us is a strange thing. And we don't handle it well, because the social contract society is premised on the blank slate view of humanity. It is premised on the idea that everyone is fundamentally the same and only made different by their social surroundings, by the civilization in which they were born and raised. And that means that everyone being rational animals, that's the usual sort of Aristotelian definition of what a human is, if we're all just rational animals, then what we can do is set up a set of laws and rules and norms that are rationally justifiable, and everyone will therefore be compelled to follow them through the innate rationality of the system that we have. And that seems reasonable on paper. That seems reasonable when you have a society that is quite homogeneous, that has a overwhelmingly vast population, the percentage of the population, who have been born and raised in a certain set of unspoken rules and assumptions and ways of doing things, sort of folk ways, in which everyone finds that to be completely normal. And so they, for most of their day, they're actually not making rational decisions. They're just following habit. They're just going through the motions as normal and as things always have been to them. And so their interaction with the state is predicated on this huge series of particulars. These particular norms for this particular place, for these specific people, following this individual history of the nation. And this is not something universalizable or interchangeable, and people who come from other countries, other civilizations, they have completely different experiences of the universe. They have completely different expectations of what people should be like. And we've brought millions of them in and said, right, okay, these are the rules and you're rational human beings and therefore carry on. Everything should be fine. Well, it turns out that actually this whole system was predicated on a specific kind of rationality, because actually there are different kinds of rationality than the modern liberal materialistic view of the universe. There are other ways of seeing the universe, and this has real consequences with what happens in society and whether someone follows the rules. And then you've got the question of mental health. What if there are populations that have dramatically higher rates of mental illness than the native population that everyone expects to just get on with life? What happens when those people have like breakdowns or episodes or whatever you want to call them? The rules of the social contract society only abide whilst everyone is a rational actor within the system and agrees to them. And the second that someone doesn't agree to them, well, then they're worth nothing and they mean nothing. And actually, it's these breaches that we're seeing that are creating the terrible environment in which we're finding ourselves, that are creating the sense of degradation and insecurity, because a lot of the people who are committing the atrocities that we're seeing on a near daily basis these days probably wouldn't be the same in other societies. Because the point of a social contract society is to make it so that everyone is essentially maximally free of one another and not dependent on social groups, not dependent on the people around them. And we assume in the English and Anglosphere countries that this is normal, because to us, this is normal. Frankly, to the Protestant world, this is normal. Having atomic and nuclear families that don't have a huge and deep web of deeply interconnected familial relations around themselves is an unusual thing. That's only the Northwest Europeans that do that. Every other place, now this is to France, the Mediterranean, obviously Africa, India, South America, wherever, everywhere else in the world has much tighter familial relations and much more extended families living in much closer proximity. I mean, this is one of the things that happened during COVID, is they found, oh, wait, COVID is by way more, it's affecting to a much greater degree the ethnic minority communities. Why is that? Well, it's often because there are multiple generations packed into a house. Like three or four generations are often packed into one household in these communities, because that's how they live. That's the normal state of life for them. And so this affects them more than it affects us. Now, it doesn't matter outside of these sort of things, it seems. But what that means, and you'll doubtless have seen Indians in particular, but like people from all over the world, when they're in public, just constantly talking on their phones. They need to be in constant communication with their friends and family, their wider support, the community network. They need to be in constant contact with these people. And to an English person, and to a Westerner generally, this is a bit weird. Like, we expect a bit of privacy, actually. Even when we're in public, we expect our privacy. And these people don't have that expectation at all. They don't have privacy at home, let alone in public. And so you can feel the difference and the distinction of having all of these people with very different social systems being put among us with our particular social systems. And so in their society, they would have people who would be closely around them, closely linked around them socially, that would be dealing with the problems that they have. But we don't provide that in the West. And often a lot of these people are not here with an extended familial or social network. And so they're just kind of left on their own. This is freedom. This is what total freedom is in the social contract society. No one owes you anything. You are to get along as best you can. And that seems normal for us, but that is wild and weird and alien to them. And we're just kind of dumping them in our society that from their perspective probably looks mad and saying, look, here are the rules, just get on with it. That's not normal. Most societies are not like this. Most societies do not have this level of freedom, and they don't think in the same way we do, and we don't understand them. And they don't understand us. And it was assumed, though, that because they're all rational animals, they're all the same rational people, these rules are... Any rational person could universally assent to these rules, and therefore they would be able to get along with us just as well as anyone else. And I think that that is being proven to be false. I actually think that the pre-rational, habitual nature of man that we are born and raised into without thinking about it, without even explaining it to ourselves when we're in school, all of these pre-rational assumptions actually really matter, because I think they take up most of a person's day. I think if you actually think about it, how many times did you sit down and derive a conclusion from premises rationally in your mind? How many times did you set out a syllogism in your head and derive a conclusion that was logically coherent? And the answer is going to be zero, practically. Very few times during the day do you actually have to perform any kind of formal logic to get through your day. Most of what you do is just habitual. And so this actually is really important, and we need to start thinking in terms that are much more particularist when it comes to who actually makes sense to be here and what we are doing to them by bringing them in. Like, we have got essentially a kind of lure on a fishing line that is the apparent material prosperity of the West and the technological advancements and success that we've had. And this is a very irresistible lure, but I think there are a lot of people who end up coming here who realize that actually, from their perspective, what we're running is a bit of a madhouse. And actually, this is not how civilization should be from their perspective. Even if we think that this is how things should be, to them, this seems kind of mad. And so, like I said, you have a situation where we've brought in millions of people who don't understand us, and we don't understand them. And we've told them, look, we've got a set of rules that, you know, in the abstract, you can rationally agree to, presumably, although there are definitely going to be examples where many of these new people are much more, say, socially conservative than the average British person. Ask the average African what they think about abortion, or ask the average Muslim immigrant what they think about, you know, abortion or gay rights or pride parades, all this sort of, and I mean, they don't agree with the rationality of how we got to the conclusions we got to with the rules that govern the social contract society. But putting that aside, they can say, well, look, if it doesn't affect me, I'm just here to make money or do whatever, and maybe it's not a problem. But this only obtains while the system hasn't effectively driven them mad. This only obtains while the logic of liberalism is prevailing over the logic of the belief systems that they have and were brought up in, either in their home country or in their local communities here, because they are still replicating the logic of their home communities in our countries. And eventually, I think that they find themselves in a position where they have to essentially choose the logic of the home country or the logic of the liberal, modern, materialist civilization. And I think a lot of them just choose the opposite. I think a lot of them just, you know, I'm actually against it, and I actually want to take revenge on society more broadly. And I think that that is a large part of what jihadi terrorism is about. So MI5 tell us that Muslim terrorism is by far the most prevalent kind of terrorism that they have to constantly foil. And they are constantly foiling terror attacks that never come to pass. And we'll talk about some of them in a minute. And most of these are from people who I'm going to say are not ethnically British, as in English, Scottish, Welsh, or Northern Irish, or Irish more broadly. But they are either themselves immigrants or the children of immigrants from non-native ethnic groups. And this is just overwhelmingly what MI5 spend their time doing. In fact, the Henry Jackson Society tells us that there are 43,000 people on the terror watch list at the moment, and 39,000 of them are Muslims. So that's an interesting statistic that makes you wonder, well, how bad could it get if there was some kind of reason to provoke these people into action? And we saw an example of that with the Manchester synagogue attack in October just a month ago, where a man called, and I'm not making this up, Jihad al-Shami, which means holy warrior from Syria, that's his real name, was brought over here as a refugee, given indefinite leave to remain, and decided that because of the Israel-Palestine conflict, what he needed to do is go to a synagogue in Manchester and kill some Jews, which is what he did. And you'll notice that these areas are deeply ethnically segregated as well. We'd kind of created a microcosm of the Israel-Palestine conflict in Manchester. There was the area in which the synagogue was about 59% Jewish, and then the area that the man was from was right next door and about 60% Muslim, something like that. And it's a question of, okay, well, what happened to the social contract society here? What are we talking about? What happened here? We said, oh, well, if you all just follow these rules rationally, then we can all just live together in peace and harmony. And Mr. Jihad al-Shami decided that actually he didn't care about the rationality of the liberal materialist order. Actually, he believes in something transcendental. He believes in a religion. And this religion and the God of the religion gives him moral instructions or imperatives that he has to follow in order to be religiously proper. And this is what all jihadi terrorism is about. It's not just madness. It's not just killing for the sake of killing. It is to be, in their interpretation of Islam, religiously proper, to do the right thing for the religion. For the same reason that Christians go to church, these jihadis commit these terror attacks. And so this is an intrinsic part of what we are dealing with in this community. Now, it's not, of course, the majority of the community, and thank God, but there is always a small percentage of this community that interprets this religion in this way and has decided to prioritize the violent and literal or excessive interpretation of the religion over the importance of following the rules set by the liberal order. And so you get the Manchester synagogue attack. And this is a perennial feature of this. And this is just the latest jihadi terrorist attack. Of course, we have had loads. We've had loads of them going in. The Manchester Arena bombing, the 7/7 attacks, the London Bridge attacks, etc., etc., etc. It goes on and on and on. You can find the Wikipedia article with the list of them if you want. But there have been plenty. And this is just a feature of life now. As we said, 39,000 of them being tracked by MI5. And I think it's worth pointing out that William the Conqueror only brought 10,000 people to conquer England when he conquered the country. I mean, 39,000 is an army. Like, that's bigger than ISIS was at its height. So just saying, that's a large number of people that MI5 are worried that will become actual terrorists. So, and it's not like we don't keep seeing individuals radicalizing themselves, presumably online, but who knows, God, however they're radicalizing, and committing atrocities. And this is just a normal feature of life because we have introduced it to the country and this has just become what this country is about. Following the social contract means putting up with occasional Islamic jihadi terrorist atrocities. That's what it means. We have to endure this to make sure that we have the rules-based liberal moral order that comes out of the Kantian principles of the categorical imperative that any rational person could consent to. In the kingdom events. I didn't agree to this. You didn't agree to this. But this is what we now have. And this isn't just immigrants either, right? Yeah, and it's very tempting to say, well, it's just an immigrant problem, isn't it? No, it's actually not just an immigrant problem. For example, there was a man called Anglo Jihadi, a recent convert called Jordan Richardson, who was arrested in December last year for carrying around a recipe for mustard gas in his rucksack, as well as plans to shoot, stab, and throw grenades at a crowd, according to deposition at Leeds Crown Court. He also had a link to ISIS bomb-making video that was used by the Manchester Arena bomber, showing how to prepare high explosives, and he had suggested an attack on a shopping center to another fellow social media user. And so he was arrested, and while he was arrested, he was told he told the prison guards that he was a supporter of the Islamic State. I mean, okay, that's great, isn't it? Now we've got some genuinely homegrown Muslim terrorism because of a ginger convert to Islam. But this is a feature of having a multicultural society. because it's highly unlikely that kid would have ended up converting to Islam had there not been a substantive Muslim community here. And with the zeal of the convert, he's decided, yeah, okay, what do I need to do? I need to attack the immoral society around me, in which I was born and raised, because actually the rules set by rationalist materialist liberalism are evil from this perspective. And I need to attack the society writ large. Like, an attack on a shopping centre or the Manchester Arena or whatever, these are not personal attacks. These are not attacks drawn from a personal motive, as in, that person over there has wronged me and I'm going to do something about it. When you have attacks, and this is the same for school shootings in America, by the way, where they are not just school shootings, just mass attacks on crowded areas where they're randomly shooting into crowds or randomly blowing up crowds or whatever it is. These are attacks symbolically on the society itself. I have access to your soft underbelly where you feel safe but are actually most vulnerable, and I'm going to attack everyone indiscriminately in this area because they are all part of the society that has either wronged me in some way or is in some way morally degenerate and needs to be corrected. And the most impactful way I, as an individual suicide attacker or terrorist, can do that is by just attacking you at random. Just, you don't know who I am, I don't know who you are, and I'm just going to attack you as representatives of the society I hate. And that's a bit of a problem, isn't it? If the social contract society is actually producing people who are prepared on a fairly regular basis to commit terror attacks or commit mass atrocities because the society itself is the problem, well, you're breeding the problem within your own borders. Like, your own rule set, your own British values are the things creating these people, because you have assumed that the logic and values of liberal modernity, the materialism and the rationalization of all rules, is universally acceptable, even to those philosophies that disagree with it. And it turns out that's just not true. And so you get suicide attacks, you get terror attacks being committed all the time. Like, this is not just in England, obviously. I'm just using England as an example. This is happening all over Europe. The people that have been brought here and allowed to replicate their culture from their homelands, actually a sizable proportion of them hate our culture and will take steps to commit atrocities against us out of this burning hatred of our culture, and us, more specifically. And so we have to ask ourselves, how long can the social contract society be allowed to produce those people who hate and murder because of what it is in relation to what they are? How long can that be permitted? How long can it be that the assumption that actually, no, everyone can live under the giant umbrella of the social contract society be permitted while it keeps producing insane murderers? And I shouldn't use the word insane, because that's the thing. They're not insane. They're using the particular logic of a transcendent religion that they feel that they have an interpretation of that sanctions this. How long can the social contract society continue to allow a philosophy to propagate, a worldview to propagate, that sanctions this kind of action against itself? And most recently, I'm going to assume that the Uxbridge stabbing was the product of jihadi terrorism, although who knows, it might have been the product of mental health or something else. It's too early to know yet because the official information hasn't been released. But this was the horrific attack in Uxbridge in the middle of the day on not only a 14-year-old boy who got attacked, a landlord who was there was an attempted murder by a chap called Safi Dawood, but the most horrific part was just the murder in broad daylight of Wayne Broadhurst, who was just walking his dog, and just completely innocently, obviously. He was a bin man, just local bin man, just respected in the area, just a normal guy, living his life, living a completely normal life. And then some Afghan immigrant who was brought in a couple of years ago, given indefinite leave to remain, just decided one day, no, I need to just murder a bunch of people here. And he just killed them. Now, is it because of Islam, or is it because he is insane? We don't know yet, but it's entirely possible that it could be from Islam. It's entirely possible that he could have been like, yeah, no, I actually can't stand this insane degenerate culture. And I need to go and murder a few people to teach them a lesson or something like that. Who knows? Like I said, we don't know. But this is one of the more brutal things that has happened recently. And it's because the footage is just horrific. Absolutely horrific to watch. Obviously, I can't play it because it's literally that bad. But it's the most, it's genuinely awful because it really brings home that, like, nowhere is safe. You can't just go and walk your dog and think that you are just safe to go and walk your dog around the local area. No, there could be someone that Boris's government, or I think, in fact, it was Robert Jemrick, when he was in the government, who snuck 25,000 of these Afghans in under the premise that, well, they helped us in Afghanistan. So, I mean, we've got to have tens of thousands of them and then their families and various other people come and live here. So they snuck them in under the dead of night during the COVID lockdowns and whatnot. And it's like, okay, great. So you just be aware that there are people on the streets now who will do this kind of thing. And this is actually not a terribly unusual thing to happen these days, is it? Shocking, but not surprising, is how I think we might characterize it. But anyway, like I said, we actually don't know what his motivation for doing this was yet. I'm sure we'll find out, and I'm sure we'll talk about it on the podcast. But we could assume that it's either Islamic extremism or it's mental health. So let's talk about mental health, because mental health is one of those kind of get-out-of-jail-free cards for the establishment, right? Oh, he didn't agree with the logic of liberal materialist individualism, and therefore the guy's just mad. He's just mad. It's like, well, in some cases, no. But in other cases, yeah, sure, I agree that actually some people are genuinely just mad. And so what do we do about them? Well, we have a system called care in the community, in which essentially mad people are just left to roam around in our community, and they are given medication on the assumption that they want to take the medication. And so they are responsible for their own treatment regime. And, I mean, they have access to, like, carers and things like that who infrequently, you know, or regularly check up on them. But for large periods of time, they're just on their own. And they're just expected to just get on with life as normal. As in, if he takes a sufficient amount of medication, he's no longer insane. Or at least the extremities, the exigencies of the insanity are kept to a minimum so he can rationally operate in the social contract society. It's like, okay, but it only takes a couple of days of him skipping that for this all to come back. And then, I mean, I'm just saying, if he has mental health problems, maybe he won't take the medication. And this is something we have actually seen. But we'll come to the specific examples in a minute, because let's talk about, again, the notion of the blank slate society, the social contract society, where everyone is just the same kind of rational animal. Well, there are, in fact, cases in which this is demonstrably, scientifically, just not true. And it's quite difficult for us to politically talk about, because actually it raises some serious questions. It turns out that the median distribution of schizophrenia across the world is 4.6 per thousand. But as the British Journal of General Practice have shown us in the study that they have, that actually that is not, like I said, evenly distributed. And there are some races that have much higher incidences than others. I'm just going to read from the abstract of a study that they've produced, because I don't want to be accused of stoking up hatred or anything like that, because of course that's not my intention. But we have to face the facts honestly. We have to actually look at what is really happening to explain a lot of what we're actually seeing and make policy informed by that. Because we can't just assume that everyone, everywhere, all the time is just the same. As they say, the incidence of schizophrenia in the black Caribbeans living in the UK is substantially higher than the white British population. When first reported, these findings were assumed to be a first-generation migrant effect, or merely the result of methodological artifacts associated with inconsistencies in the diagnosis of schizophrenia in black Caribbeans and doubts about population denominators. More recently, it has become clear that the incidence of schizophrenia based on standardized diagnoses and sophisticated census methods is higher still in second-generation black Caribbeans. The largest study to date has demonstrated a 9-fold higher risk of schizophrenia in UK resident Black Caribbeans. So, Black Caribbeans in the United Kingdom have a ninefold prevalence of schizophrenia in their community. This is a really concerning thing, and they're not sure why it's happening. It could be that it is just intrinsic to this community, but it's more likely that there, I mean, there may well, obviously there's probably going to be some sort of genetic difference and disposition, because of course the different peoples of the earth are genetically different, but it's also quite likely to be a product of lifestyle, because the Black Caribbean community smokes a lot of cannabis, and at the risk of invoking Peter Hitchens, it seems there might be a connection between cannabis usage and schizophrenia. As they tell us, evidence is accumulating that cannabis may be a potent trigger for the development of schizophrenia, but it's of course not entirely sure. Case managers surveyed in South London reported that black-born British patients with schizophrenia were significantly more likely to be using cannabis than white British patients, or Black Caribbeans or Africans when they were born abroad. So it may be that the schizophrenics are smoking cannabis, which I'm sure isn't helping, but might not be the cause of their schizophrenia, or it might be that cannabis users are developing schizophrenia. As they say, the evidence is accumulating that it might be a trigger, although it might be a correlative. Who knows? The point being, there is a community in this country that has a much higher incidence of paranoid schizophrenia, which often manifests in particularly violent ways, and we're not doing anything about this. And so this becomes another normal thing, a normal aspect of the social contract society that assumes that all people are just blank slates, and therefore they are completely identical in not just their genetics, but in their behaviors, their social structures, their habits, and the way that these things manifest in their lives, and the consequences of this. The social contract society can't distinguish between these cultures, between these communities, and therefore can't do anything to resolve this problem. And there are some genuinely awful examples of where this has been the cause of a terrifying and atrocious mass killing event. You'll remember the Nottingham stabbings in 2023, where Valdo Callow Kane was not on his schizophrenia meds and decided to go on a mass stabbing and killed three people in cold blood. It was absolutely atrocious. I'll just read from the BBC. Barnaby Webber, Grace O'Malley Kumar, and 65-year-old Ian Coates were killed by Calcone, who is psychotic and suffering from paranoid delusions, on the 13th of June 2023. The Care Quality Commission on Tuesday found a series of errors and omissions and misjudgments by mental health services. Their review said key risk factors in Calcone's case had either been missed or omitted, including his refusal to take medicine, his persistent symptoms of psychosis, and a level of violence towards other people. Without actions, it said, the issues would continue to pose an inherent risk to public safety, because he had been diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia 3 years before the killings, and it was assumed that he would just want to take his meds. Well, what if he doesn't? What if he doesn't want to take his meds? Well, three people died, two 19-year-olds and a 65-year-old, just murdered in broad daylight. It's insane, insane that we're allowing this to happen. Like, paranoid schizophrenics probably shouldn't just be given medication and then left to roam the country. But then you've got Axel Rudakabana. Now, I don't have an official diagnosis of paranoid schizophrenia from him, but he had been in trouble repeatedly over and over and over and clearly had some kind of problems. And this was something that they had specifically gone out of the way to try and minimize when he had had interactions with the authorities. I assume they were trying to be racially sensitive or something, but that turned out pretty bloody awfully, didn't it? They'd diagnosed Rudakabana with autism and put together a care report, an education, health and care plan designed to deal with it. And they had spent their time watering it down because, I mean, for God only knows what reasons, it looks like sensitivity reasons. But the report had originally stated that there were concerns of occasions where Axel would say and do things that would have been described as sinister, inappropriate. And that sentence had been deleted, along with a line that said, Axel can also appear to be cold and calculating. Another line said that when Rudakabana had difficulty managing when things go wrong, he becomes very angry, which was also deleted. So, bit of a problem. The sort of person who might not actually be that worried about the rational rules of the social contract order and might just say, you know what, I'm just going to go on a mass stabbing spree, say at a Taylor Swift-themed dance class, which it seems to be what happened. And of course, then we learned that Rudy Cabana was obsessed with genocides and had materials about white genocide, had said to someone that what this country needs is a white genocide. And so we are dealing with not only the looming prospect of serious mental health problems, but also a kind of deep ethnic resentment against the white British population. And the fact that his dad had stopped him doing this the week prior, but didn't alert any of the authorities, didn't do anything else, and had essentially allowed his son to continue roaming freely so he could go on his mass stabbing. But we've got a real problem here that isn't being addressed. And this is something that I think we're still seeing cropping up. So, for example, in the Huntingdon train stabbings, the suspect is called Anthony Williams. And according to one passenger called Dana Arnold, she told the Telegraph that she saw the attacker coming at her with a knife. I said, please, please don't. Then something changed in his eyes, and he said, the devil's not going to win. I mean, I don't know why he's done this. The information of this isn't out yet. But if I concluded paranoid schizophrenia from this, is it a fair assumption? And he had already stabbed, earlier in the day, a 14-year-old boy. He'd burst into a barbershop elsewhere in the country with this giant knife, threatening the people in there. Somehow he wasn't arrested for these things. And then he went on this train, the Huntingdon train, and stabbed 10 people. I think one died. Luckily, many of the others didn't. But this is just mad, right? This is indicative of a community that has serious problems that the social contract order is actually not prepared to address, not capable of addressing, because it can only deal with these things individually when, in fact, it seems that there might be a community problem. Like, for example, the other day in Swindon, or last month it was in Swindon, a gang of youths just stomped a kid unconscious and hospitalized him outside of a school for no reason at all, just because they wanted to attack someone, and they gleefully filmed it and then sent it to him. They sent it to him on Snapchat, and the police found no crime was committed. And it's like, right, am I going to assume that there's no ethnic dimension to this? Am I going to assume that this isn't also a consequence of maybe mental health problems or something like that? Or is this just a normal cultural habit for this community? Either way, we really have to be able to address these things. And the police have decided no crime was committed. And the worst thing that happened to any of these boys is a suspension, with one of them being expelled. Like, that's not acceptable, right? We have to be able to deal with these things, or else the social contract society is once again allowing and creating communities that simply don't abide by its rules and don't care about what it thinks or says or does. Like, if they want to break the rules, then they'll just break the rules. They aren't actually being rational in the things that they do. They're actually fulfilling awful and base desires, or there is, like with the case of Anthony Williams and Axel Rudy Cabana, they appear to be insane. And Valdo Calcone, they appear to be genuinely insane and incapable of controlling their own actions, or just merciless. In the case of Rudy Cabana in particular, cold, calculating, and sinister, and angry against white people, and wants a white genocide. We have to be able to deal with these things before they manifest in mass killings or public beatings for no reason, gang beatings, and various other things. Like, we have to be able to deal with these things. And if we can't, then the social contract society, like I said, is creating another constituency for itself that doesn't abide by the rules that are supposed to justify creating that constituency in the first place. These people are not native to this country. And that's an issue that we'll get to in a bit. But the last thing I want to say on this as well, when we talk about foreign peoples being brought here and then not actually following the rules-based order, is that you don't understand just how different a lot of these foreign peoples are, right? You don't understand that they aren't just the sort of rules-following Northwestern Europeans that we are. And in fact, their entire cultures, their entire worldviews are completely different to us. So there was a video recently going around about the African view of time, in which the future doesn't really exist. The present is the immediate moment. And then the past is this kind of dream time that just goes on forever and everything just flows into. And so this African philosopher explained that Africans basically walk backwards through time. And they're always looking at what's happened in the past, or what's directly in front of them. But they're not thinking long-term into the future. Whereas Europeans definitely think long-term into the future. Most other peoples think long-term into the future. And so that's just one of those ways where it's like, right, okay, that's an entirely different way of looking at the universe to us. And we assume that they'll be like, yeah, no, I agree with the rational rules-based order. That makes perfect sense to me. It's like, well, does it? Are we sure about that, right? But not only that, then you have the weird problems that we have imported from these places. Like, obviously, child genital mutilation is a feature of the Islamic world that we've brought into this country. And, well, it's something that happens quite often, actually, tens of thousands every year. And what are we supposed to do about that? What's the government's response to that? Because that would be specifically to target a specific kind of community and say, you're not allowed to do this. But they don't do that because they can only individualize each single problem. And so, okay, well, we just have to wait for another one to happen, another one to happen, another one to happen. And even if it's consistently through this community, they've got to be like, well, there's nothing further we can say. It's the same problem with the grooming gangs. It's like, look, if you can't talk about it as a community issue, then you can't really talk about it accurately. But the logic of liberal individualism and the social contract society says, no, things are only individual. And therefore, we can only deal with these individual things as and when they pop up. But that leaves a residual kind of stain on that community. People are aware that the community itself knew that these things are happening, or that the community itself knows that child genital mutilation happens, that it knows that grooming gangs happen, that it knows that these things go on and are a kind of permitted part of the community because it's the culture from the old countries. And so we just have to accept that the social contract society can do nothing about that. It just has to live with them. These are just things that when they come up, we'll criminalize, we'll punish, but they can't be prevented. They can't be anticipated. They can't be dealt with in advance instead of allowing these things to happen, because that would be racist. And like I said, there are a bunch of very strange practices that are brought over here from the old world, from their old countries, that we have no particular experience of. Like, large amounts of Africans believe in witchcraft and, I mean, I just call it witchcraft, I suppose. I don't have a better term for it, because obviously we don't believe in that kind of stuff. And so very few people abuse, mutilate, or kill children or other adults based on witchcraft. We don't really have much experience of that. I mean, the last person who really did that was like Matthew Hopkins in the 17th century. And he was really doing it for the money, not for the true belief in the thing, I suspect. But this is something that happens a lot. And there are loads of studies about African witchcraft that has resulted in various forms of child abuse, various forms of mutilation, and is a problem that the British state just doesn't know what to do about. What are they supposed to do about Africans with beliefs in witchcraft? They genuinely think this. They genuinely view the world as being imbued with spirits that can be manipulated by witches, that their enemies, people who they dislike, or, you know, demons or whoever, are doing this. And therefore, they do terrible things to, say, children or to whoever based on this. And it's like, okay, what's our plan for that? What's the social contract society's plan for witchcraft sacrifices? Because that's something that's happened in this country. That's something we genuinely have to think about. And yet we don't know what we're doing. And we can't address it on its own level, on a spiritual level, because our culture is irredeemably atheist and materialist. And we can't deal with it on a community level, because that would be prejudicial. And so we're just sat here going, well, I guess when it comes up, we'll just punish the guy who does it. It's like, yeah, okay, that's probably not a great comfort for the victims, right? The victims would probably like to not have been victimized, assuming they're still alive afterwards, to have the opinion. Same with the grooming gangs. Same with the terror attacks. Like, prevention is always better than cure. And so the liberal establishment on both the left and the right is left in the unfortunate position of having to conclude that actually this is all fine. This is exactly the system working as intended, and this is what you can expect going forward into the future. More of the same is going to produce more of this, and this is going to be completely normal, so get used to it. Both Fraser Nelson and Owen Jones have published pieces saying, no, crime isn't up in this country. Crime is actually down across the board. Everything is getting better. Material prosperity is apparently increasing, even while you look outside of your house and you realize everything is decaying and the streets are filled with strangers and everything is getting far less safe. They're convinced that the numbers that they have on their charts represent true reality and your actual experience outside is actually a false reality, a false consciousness that you have of the world. And so they're convinced that this is all fine. And they draw this from the National Crime Survey, which is a survey that goes beyond what the police actually record, because they're well aware that the police are simply not recording all of the crimes that are happening in this country. And the crime survey, they tell us, excludes crime against commercial or public sector bodies, tourists, or those living in communal establishments like care homes, student halls of residence, and prisons. The survey does not cover crimes where there is not a specific victim, such as drug possession, or the crimes against the state. The headline crimes include theft, robbery, criminal damage, fraud, computer misuse, and violence with or without injury. Details of these crimes are collected through interviewer-administered sectors of the survey, and the estimates are reported as both incidents, the estimated number of crimes, and prevalence, the estimated proportion of the population that were victims. And so what Fraser Nelson and Owen Jones do is compress all of the crimes into a single graph of total crimes committed in the country and say, well, look, this is down. And overall, that might be true. Like, if you look at the graphs that they'll present of just generally violent crimes, you'll notice that they peak in like 2005 and then they tail off. It's like, well, yeah, but that includes, for example, instances of guys going to the pub, getting drunk and having a punch up outside, or someone being assaulted wherever, just in a fist fight or something like that. That's all violent crimes. But actually, if you become more slightly more granular about this and say, pick a certain kind of crime, you'll realize that this has actually gone up by orders of magnitude. We can take, for example, crimes with knives or sharp instruments. In 2005-2006, there were 32,820 offenses, according to crimeandjustice.org.uk. But according to the National Crime Survey, last year, there were 51,527 offences. So that's nearly doubled in the last 20 years. Knife crime. And you can look at the knife murders, the deaths by knife crime per year. In 2014-2015, it lulled at 186, which is mercifully fairly low. But last year, in 2023-2024, it was 262. So it's not like that's gone down either. And okay, it's not great that you, in 2005 you had a much higher chance of being beaten up outside the pub or something by some guy who's drunk or whatever it is. But I'd prefer that over getting knifed, which is much more likely now than it was back in 2005. So just saying, the kinds of crimes, even just down to violent crimes, are not consistent. They are not the same. They are not, in my opinion, equal or equivocal. It would be better to have more violent crimes but less knife crimes than less violent crimes overall but way more knife crimes. And if you look at different kinds of crimes, such as, I don't know, sexual assaults, for example, they're actually skyrocketing. Back in 2006, sexual assaults were reported to be about 16,000 a year for the entire country, which is terrible, obviously. But now, last year, that was 40,000 instances of rape and sexual assault. So Fraser Nelson can say, well, I don't know what you're talking about. Violent crime is down overall. Well, maybe, but if you're a woman walking around and you're worried about being sexually assaulted or raped, you're in a lot more danger. If you're a young person who's worrying about being stabbed, you're in a lot more danger. And this is the direct violent attacks against the person as well. There are other kinds of crimes that are at record levels. The House of Lords held a committee last year that investigated smash and grab robberies. So people, just youths going into shops and just grabbing stuff and then running out. This is an epidemic that is at record levels. They held this committee into tackling shoplifting, which heard evidence from police chiefs, retailers, and industry experts. And they found that there were 44,000 incidents of shop theft recorded by police in the year up to March 2024, the highest since records began 20 years ago. So this is as bad as it has ever been, and it just contributes to the general sense of degradation and unsafety in the country. And, of course, these crimes are basically not solved. In fact, most crimes are not solved in this country. So not only are, in certain categories, these crimes higher than they've ever been, but the people doing them are also getting away with them. And that's not including the times where the government's just like, yeah, suspended sentence. The judiciary's suspended sentence. He doesn't go to jail. We're not going to press charges any further. When the police don't bother taking action, like in the Swindon case with the youth beating up the boy, like where they're just like, yeah, it's just not our problem. We're not going to take action into it. That's not including all of those times. So you can say things are getting better, but sorry, I don't think they are. And we'll look at the numbers, in fact, of crimes that are just not solved, shall we, right? So according to the government, this is their own statistics, for sexual offences, it's 4.2% of them that are solved. Theft offences were 7.3%. 1 in 9 offences involving a firearm came to a charge and summons outcome. And for knife crimes, it was about 11.5%. For knife-enabled robbery offences, 9%. Knife-enabled assaults, 13.2%. So basically, about 90%, and that's those crimes where a weapon is involved. There are other kinds of those crimes that are about 6 or 7%. So overall, if you average it out, about 90% of crime in this country goes unsolved. There's no charge or summons. Nothing happens to the people committing these crimes. And that is even assuming these numbers are vaguely accurate, which they might not be. As the BBC reported in August, a report from the Majesty's Inspectorate of Constabulary and Fire and Rescue Services estimated that about 5% of crimes went unrecorded. Now, that's 280,000 crimes by their estimate. But who knows? It could be way more. This could be way worse. Who knows? We don't have the numbers, but we do know that what is reported is basically going uninvestigated. I mean, there are areas in London, there are something like 16 different boroughs in London, where a crime hadn't been solved in the last 3 years. The police have just given up on it. And when something terrible happens, when it's on video, and you know the people involved, like, for example, in the case of the Swindon boy got beaten up by the gang of youths, the police just like, yeah, we just decided there's not a criminal act here and we're going to take no further action. What do you do? How can you say, yeah, no, this is the society as it's meant to be, Fraser Nelson and Owen Jones? If this is what you think, your social, the ideal, the British values are supposed to be building, the social contract society that you have been putting into place and supporting your entire careers, well, I'm sorry, I'm against this. I think we should have a much more traditional approach to not only these communities, but the crimes that are coming out of them as well, and crime in general, obviously. I think we need a much more draconian approach towards crime. I think that we should be sequestering people with mental health conditions, such as schizophrenia, away from the general public. Make asylums great again. They don't have to be like Victorian asylums. They could be essentially mandatory daycare centres, where these people get to play their PlayStations all day, eat nice food, go for walks on nice, you know, in the greenery, in the grass, whatever, and are forced to take their meds. I don't think they should just be care in the community, allowed to roam around at will. And I mean, there are so many other points. But this all becomes very clear to the British public that actually, if these people weren't here, we wouldn't be dealing with any of these problems. What this has made many people in Britain realize is that the communities of foreign extraction that have been planted in our country have brought with them many problems that the government, the state, and the governing philosophy of this country is unprepared to deal with. They have no answer for any of these problems. And in fact, the only thing that they can say is, no, you're going to have to expect more of the same. You're going to have to take it on the chin. You're going to have to tough it out. And that's the only answer that they have. And so people are like, well, actually, I think there are other answers. Even if the liberal materialist state won't recognize them, there are other solutions to these problems that would act as preventatives. So fewer people are raped and murdered. And I'm actually in favor of those. And this has become a problem for the British liberal class, because they're like, no, 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 this is our dream. We are currently living the dream. We are currently instantiating human rights universally across the country. So this is as good as it can possibly get. And if you think things are getting worse, you're wrong. Crime is at an all-time low. We've never been more prosperous. And if you think these people are not just as British as you, then you're a bigot. And I hate you. Basically, a lot of people are asking themselves, why are they lying about the nature of what's happening here? Why is it that the British political class is committed to a series of carefully constructed lies and outright denials of reality? Why are they committed to them being just as British as you? And this is something that you'll see the commentariat come out with all the time. Every time that there is a terrible atrocity, they'll dig into it and they'll be like, oh, look at that. He was given indefinite leave to remain, or he was a British national, he'd been given citizenship, or, and this is their favourite one, he was born here, therefore he is just as British as you. You might well be able to trace your ancestry back to Cheddar Man 9,000 years ago, who was found in Cheddar Gorge, and his descendant was found just around the corner as a working as a history teacher. But this chap, you know, Jihad al-Shami, for example, well, he was given indefinite leave to remain a couple of years ago, and the British passport was issued to him. Therefore, he is just as British, because the social contract society only recognizes the legal acts of the state as creating the people within the state as being British or not British. And so if the legal acts of the state, by literally executive fiat, has issued out passports like they're going out of fashion, well then, what legal avenue do you have to say these people aren't British? And the answer is, you don't. If that guy's got a British passport, well then, surely he's a British citizen. And if he's a British citizen, that's all the legalistic framework needs for this particular philosophy to recognize him as one of ours. And so Mr. Jihad al-Shami, or Axel Rudakabana, or Anthony Williams from the Huntingdon train attack, these are all just as British as you, and you are a racist for trying to observe a distinction. You are a racist for saying, oh, there is a problem with a minority community in this country that has brought in to this country problems that we did not previously have. And so they have to lie. They have to say, these people are just as British as you. And they have to then fall back on the idea of integration. Well, he was born here. He's a Welsh choir boy. He must be British because he was born here. Even though the question of integration is clearly off the table at this point. I mean, in many of these communities, of course, immigration has made it so there are just basically zero British people around. Or British people themselves are the overwhelming minority in these communities. And therefore, how could they integrate into British culture? It in fact seems that it's going the other way if the Anglo-Jihadi is any measure of that statement. But you have this problem, and this is really glaringly demonstrated in Tower Hamlets, which is essentially a Bangladeshi colony, which is why at the Whitechapel station, it's written in English and Bangladeshi. Because there are so many people from Bangladesh who do not speak English in this community that they need to put up a sign for practical reasons, so they can use the underground. And Tower Hamlets is a great example of this, because there are councillors of Bangladeshi extraction in Tower Hamlets on the council, who just advocate for Bangladeshi interests non-stop, but then will go back to Bangladesh and campaign for the Bangladeshi National Party. There is currently a councillor in Tower Hamlets who is campaigning in Bangladesh for their national party. Whereas, of course, in Britain, they're councillors for the very, very progressive Aspire Party. They're very progressive over here, but deeply nationalistic over there. And so the question is often raised, and we'll take the example of Mike Galsworthy, who raised it on Twitter the other day. When he's responding to Matt Goodwin, who's saying, well, look, these people aren't British, he replies, well, please continue, Matt. What does make someone British, if not a piece of paper saying that they are British? What an incredible take. Again, the opinion precisely of the rationalistic, legalistic social contract society, it is a piece of paper that determines that denotes whether you belong here or not. And therefore, it's done by authority, it's done by the government, it's done by the legal system, and it's done by fiat. It is not done by something outside of the control of the establishment. It is not that you were born here after 1,000 generations of people stretching back to Cheddar Man or anything like that. That gives you no greater claim to this country than does Jihad al-Shami being allowed in by the Conservative government, being given indefinite leave to remain by some person in the Home Office or whoever did it. It doesn't matter what they think or feel. It doesn't matter if they're a councillor here and then a BNP party supporter in their own country. None of that matters. The rational liberal state cannot draw a distinction between these two people because it can only see them as theoretical individuals on its ledgers. It doesn't understand what it truly is to be British. And so if I've, say, pointed out to Mike, say, look, it's done by lineage, Mike. It's done by your inheritance from your parents. All he can come back with and say, well, look, are you saying that these people aren't actually British? The royal family, British Jews or Zia Yusuf? It's like, well, I mean, Charles is descended from Elizabeth, descended from Harold Godwinson and William the Conqueror. So I think he's actually got a claim. But yes, people that you determine as being from elsewhere are actually not native to Britain. That's correct. Jews are from Judea. Zia Yusuf is from Sri Lanka. And these people would surely agree with this. They would surely say, yeah, no, of course, we're originally from Judea. We're not from Britain, obviously, which is what the claim to the state of Israel is predicated on, that this is the native homeland of the Jewish people. And Zia Yusuf has obviously has said many a time, yeah, I'm not English or Scottish or Welsh or Northern Irish, but he's still a patriot. He still seems to like this country. He's still in the right-wing party. And the thing is, that's fine. I mean, Suella Braverman recently came out and said the same thing. Look, I'm not ethnically British, but I have British nationality legally, but there is more to it than that. And the British liberal can't accept this. But the thing is, we hear from them all the time when it's their own minority interests about how they're not British, when they want, say, reparations. I mean, you remember David Lammy saying that he is Caribbean, he represents the Caribbean community, and by God, they want their reparations. Same with Lenny Henry coming out and saying, look, I want reparations too. It's like, Lenny, I thought you were British. Like, Lenny Henry is an old chap at this point, and he's been a comedian for many, many years. And back in like the 70s and 80s and 90s, he was a famous comedian in this country, and nobody thought of him as being not British. But all of a sudden, now, he's like, yeah, no, I'm Caribbean. I'm Black Caribbean. I want reparations. Well, reparations from who, Mr. Lammy, Mr. Henry? Reparations from who? From the British? Are you paying yourselves reparations? Or is this an admission that you know that you're also not British? And if that's the case, why can't the state recognize that? Is David Lammy literally going to be taxed to pay himself reparations? Because that's what he's asking for. That's what would have to be the case under the social contract society. That he can't define it any other way. And so we see the contradiction being revealed before us. We can see that not only do the Bangladeshi nationalists in Tower Hamlets not think of themselves as British, I doubt Jihad al-Shami thinks of themselves as very British, but also David Lammy and Lenny Henry also reveal that they don't think of themselves as British either, because they are expecting something from the British. And yet, those of us who are actually British, we've got to pretend, we've got to sit there with the lie that the passport makes someone as British as you or I, or the fact that he was born here makes him as British as you or I, or else we're called names. It's like, but you guys admit that you're not British, and you still expect things from us on those terms. And yet at the same time, if we say, well, look, if all of these non-British people weren't here, then a lot of these problems wouldn't be happening. We have to instead go for the double think, accept the double think, that actually they're just as British as us, and they've been as British as us the whole time. There's no distinction because of this piece of paper. And these arguments are falling flat these days. The British public is well aware that actually there is something going on here that is not to our benefit. And we're in fact being taken for a ride. The British values that we are being constantly propagandized with are actually creating more problems than they're solving. And so the people who are in defense of these are starting to get their back up about it. A good example of this is Lewis Goodall, who is, of course, an LBC commentator and on the news agents, whatever. And he is kind of essentially the mouthpiece of the liberal establishment. And he, on his LBC show the other day, complained about the, quote, reflexive racism of the British public. When a terrible atrocity happens, such as an Islamic terror attack or a schizophrenic man going on, a Caribbean man going on a mass stabbing or something like that, he complains that there is a reflexive racism in the British public. Oh, which foreigner did this, is the attitude that people are taking. And he finds it disgusting. He finds it completely horrible. But the problem that he has is that it's very rarely wrong. And in it being rarely wrong shows that there has been an increase in danger from the rise of mass immigration, from the immigration that has been forced upon us. Of course, a population that never wanted immigration in the first place. And so what this means to him, the reason he renders this as disgusting and wrong, is not because it's incorrect, is not because it doesn't represent what's happening, it's because it attacks morally the foundations of the social contract society. It attacks the assumptions that it has made. At the root is that we're just all the same. The blank slate is the correct way of approaching human interactions and the human assumptions. And so the rational argument for immigration is not just attacking it on its moral foundations, although it is. It's attacking it on its own rational foundations. If the blank slate is not correct, then the social contract society as a rational endeavor is also not correct. And so to impose this on the country is actually irrational and against what actually reality is as it is represented in the real world by the actual facts of the cases. What this means then is not only have they been irrational, not only have they gone against the true beliefs that they genuinely hold, that everyone is a rational individual lone agent that just goes around doing rational things all day, every day, but they're also the ones who are going to be left with the blood on their hands, because it was on these irrational assumptions that they dressed up as rational that they brought all of these people in, that they failed to address any of the problems, and they bore witness to and were basically in defense of the terrible atrocities that are happening, because the atrocities are a product of the system and they are the defenders of the system. And so no wonder Lewis Goodall's like, yeah, oh my God, it's disgusting that you would admit these things that appear to be true, because then I look like I'm culpable because I was in defense of the system that produced them. And so you have dinosaurs like Michael Heseltine, the Tory grandee, coming out of his retirement, I suppose is what you'd call it, at the age of 92, and having these lovely write-ups in the Times, where the first half of this article describes how he's just in his gardens, and he's tending his trees and his flowers, and he's living in this very remote, very gated community in a 90-plus percent white English area, complaining that the politics of the middle 20th and the late 20th century no longer obtain in the early 21st century. Back when he was born, Britain was about 98% white British. Back when he was in government, it was about 97% white British. And when he finally left politics, it was about 95% white British. And now, in England, it's about 75% English. But that's according to the 2021 census, before the Boris wave. And even then, that wasn't taken into account however many millions of illegals were here anyway. So we actually don't know the percentage of England that is still English. Hopefully, it's about 70%. It could be as low as 65%. Like I said, we don't know. And he complains that Reform are a right-wing party. Then they're fascist, essentially, is what he says. He says this: I want to expose Reform for what they actually are. He believes that in some ways they are the reincarnation of Oswald Mosley and his fascists in the 30s, when it was Jews who were the target, and of Enoch Powell with immigrants in the 60s. Farage is the reincarnation of that human instinct to distrust something different from yourself. We have seen it all throughout our history. The War of the Roses, Catholics versus Protestants. We have been there before and I hate it. I want to tell the Conservative Party, with all the experience that I may have, they must never do a deal with Farage. The world has changed, and he has not updated his understanding of the world to accept it. Now, he's 92, so I'm not surprised he's a bit stuck in his ways. And I'm not surprised that he thinks the country is as it was back in the 1970s and 1980s. But that world has moved on. That world has gone, and unfortunately for him, it is not merely about now victimizing innocent minorities who have done nothing wrong. Actually, we can see what's happening with these communities, and we can understand why it's happening. We have lots of evidence to suggest these are real problems, and unfortunately, this kind of universalist, liberal, social contract morality can't deal with the issues. So all they can do is promise more of the same. All they can do is say, well, look, we can't address any of it, or else you'd be a racist. You'd be the reincarnation of Oswald Mosley, which is just absurd to think that. Nigel Farage is the reincarnation of Oswald Mosley. And it also is a way of deflecting from admitting that the politics that they agreed with their whole lives, and even till this day, has created this state of affairs. It's a way of trying to avoid taking any of the blame, shouldering it, having any culpability in the way that things are now. But you are the people who brought us to this point. It's all of you guys, the entire political establishment, that has brought us to this place and has left you essentially on the outside of your own project because of the manifest problems that you, in your arrogance, assumed wouldn't pop up because you thought you knew what human nature was. You thought you knew that actually people are all rational, universal, individualistic animals that will all agree on the same set of principles and premises and therefore can live multiculturally side by side with no problems at all. And reality has come back and slapped you in the face. That's not how it works. And actually, your precious rules, your precious social contract, that only lasts as long as the people involved care about it. And as soon as they don't, terrible things ensue. So what can we conclude from all of this? Well, we can conclude, I think, that the liberal paradigm of the 20th century that was accelerated under Tony Blair and accelerated even further under Boris Johnson is coming to an end. I think that the excesses of it have been manifested throughout the terrible amounts of crime and terrible amounts of terror attacks and various other mass casualty events that we've had, and it can't go on forever. What we're looking at is the paradigm of the 20th century finally breaking down in the 21st. Now, that's going to leave a lot of people on the outside and left holding the bag on this, being the ones who are responsible for this, and they aren't prepared to try and change their positions on anything in order to account for the new reality. But things are getting worse. They're not getting better. Things are genuinely part of community problems. Things are genuinely outside of the control of the state. And I'm adopting a very narrow view of the problems, but I think these are the core problems that are the real issue. But the problems are, of course, way wider than this. Like, I'm not talking about the economy. I'm not talking about the amount of taxation, the amount of state spending. I'm not talking about the second and third order consequences of mass immigration, such as the difficulty of getting a job, the suppression of wages, the increasing of the price of housing and renting. I'm not talking about the fact that everything is just getting more expensive and that everything is just getting outside of people's reaches. I'm not talking about any of those things. I'm talking about the questions of the nature and composition of the civic polity itself, of the national identity, and of the problems that are generated by communities that are just invisible to the liberal establishment. Like, that's, I'm only talking about one narrow pillar of the perennial and repeated failures of this liberal order. And we are watching it, like I said, in real time, break down in front of us. And so what does that mean? Well, that means that the people who decided that we're going to rub diversity in our faces, well, the Boris wave is rubbed diversity right back in their faces. And now it seems that this project is just unsalvageable. Like, I don't know how they could, from their own principles, from their own paradigm, from their own philosophy, attempt to address any of these problems. Because a lot of these problems are collective, they are communal, and they are non-rational. They are not problems that can be solved with a further application of laws. And you'll notice whenever anything happens, that's the first thing to get to. Well, I mean, we're just going to have to ban knives. Oh, we'll have to ban zombie knives. We're going to have to ban this, ban that, ban the other. As if this is the problem. It's, oh, we had a... an insufficient amount of laws, which is why we didn't get these kind of things happening back in like the 1990s or the 2000s or whatever. Like it's as if the insufficient, overbearing nature of the state has not yet created the utopia. But again, even if we had the digital ID, if we had weapon scanners going into trains like we do on planes and things like this, even if we turn ourselves into a tyrannical dystopian police state, that only works assuming the police are actually going to enforce the laws. And we've seen repeatedly that the police only enforce the laws against those who are compliant. You will get extra taxes. You will get digital ID. You will get the arrested for things you post online. But the people who are not compliant with the state, who do not consent to be policed by the state, well, they won't. They'll get away with their crimes. They will just continue to steal from shops. They will continue to engage in violent behaviours. They will continue to take on, you know, like, do all sorts of things, like 90% of gun crime being unsolved, all that sort of stuff. They will continue to do these things. And you just have to hope that it doesn't happen to you. Because this is the world getting markedly worse. It's degrading in front of us. Law and order breaking down. This is the society in decay, and they can't arrest it because it is the very nature of the operating principles that they have brought into play that has created this. They can only produce more of the same. And so the best they've been able to do up until this point is keep a lid on it, to stigmatize you. You're concerned about grooming gangs? Oh, you're a racist. You're an Islamophobe. Concerned about this? You're a homophobe. You're a this, you're a that, you're a xenophobe, you're whatever. They had all sorts of social tools to keep a lid on all of this for many, many years, but the problems kept increasing, and they kept growing, and they kept getting worse. And now it's got to the point where I don't think they can keep a lid on it. I don't think any amount of social censure or censorship will actually be able to keep people from properly understanding what the problems are. And this is why I think that people overwhelmingly are voting to the right. The right are the ones currently in the driver's seat, culturally. And soon, it looks like it'll be Nigel Farage in the driver's seat politically. And if he had a vision, then he would be able to overthrow and overturn this whole order. Of course, I don't think he's going to do that. I think what he's going to try and do is essentially prop up a system that is in decay. But I don't think he'll arrest the decay by doing more of the same. And so expect tomorrow, or the day after, or the day after that, the terrible things you read about on the news, they could be you.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com, and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.